Good morning, and we are live about 9 a.m. here in beautiful Belgrade, Serbia, on this August 4th. That would be a Thursday. Just checking in with you, just making sure I'm on the right day of the week, making sure I'm at the right time of the day, making sure I'm in the right location. All right. Today we're talking about, obviously, as we said, China situation there. People always want to know what's going to happen next. And I always say, to know what's going to happen next, you got to know what happened first. So we go backward to look forward, right? Looking at the past, you can look at what, you know, what's really going on in China. There's a lot of games. The media is lying. Everybody lying. Everybody's lying about it. The Chinese are lying on both sides. The so-called Taiwanese Chinese and the mainline Chinese. All of this is a rather holographic, contrived, fake crisis scenario. The Chinese are using this pretext for a lot of things. Seizing Taiwan, they don't need to. They could. They could have all along, in fact. There's nothing been stopping them. This could have happened at any time. So why hasn't it? And what are we actually looking at? And what's really going on besides a lot of the stuff that we're being fed? And it can be very difficult because we can conflate some things that we don't want to conflate. Let me make sure that my audio quality doesn't sound like I'm underwater. We're not talking about inherent, whatever, congenital problems with my voice or, you know, like a raspiness. We're talking about, like, if it sounds like I'm underwater or like I'm too close to the mic and it sounds very distorted in a certain way. So just checking on that. Let me know in comments right now if the mic is tolerable. Yeah. So, look, China at this time, right now, could do something big in the sense that our eyes would expect on China. Thanks for the sound check. They could. But we're going to talk about really what's going on behind the story a little bit to give some background. Because once you understand the background, it's a kind of a different story. And what people are really saying. And, you know, what's really the story with Taiwan and China in reality. A lot of this stuff is being created problems from the outside that the Chinese have sorted out between themselves. And that includes the Taiwanese who are Chinese. Effectively, what happened is reality happened, okay? The struggle to create a Chinese nation, okay, was not only an anti-colonial struggle. Would you talk about the remnants of the Dutch, of the Portuguese, the Spanish, and particularly the English? You have to understand, so that's a very big component of this, how one Chinese faction from a civil war in China that lost fled to Taiwan and established their base of operations and a government in exile at the time. But this is not really a government in exile in the international sense until later on, okay? You know, when the Republic of China lost its seat, okay, at the UN. So the mainland China, right, from 1949 until 1971 was not recognized as a country on planet Earth, despite it being, you know, the most populous country on planet Earth. And what was recognized as the legal authority representative of that, right? Just like Zelensky's government running out of Poland or Lviv or whatever that's going to be. consider Lviv to be the Taiwan of of Ukraine or something. And at the end of the day, losing this conflict, they moved to a tiny island and they set up a base of operations, not as a breakaway state, but as a government in their own minds and really in their own minds alone running China. Is there a precedent for this? You know, and I was trying to think about that, and even in Chinese history, and you do have, you'd have to go back. I was racking my brain, and you have to go back to, you know, 400 years ago or something like this, and you have the these changes in history. You have the transition of power around 400 years ago. What is it? The Ming-Qing transition. And you have basically the displacement of the old ruling dynasty and the coming of the Manchurian dynasty, which are the northern nobility, had been integrated into that kind of Chinese system. You go back to legendary Chinese history and quasi-mythical Three Kingdoms and stuff like this. You have Manchurians, right? And we know also, like, the Japanese had established Manchuria as an independent state as a Japanese puppet state, like the independent state of Croatia in the Second World War, was neither really a state nor independent, right? So we have this kind of Holy Roman Empire phenomenon, neither holy nor Roman, nor really an empire. And likewise, Taiwan was not a government in exile. And that's really where we get into this interesting stuff, okay? Now, reality, and the reason that we showed some of these trade things, and there's a lot more data behind this, but if you look at figure one, you're looking at the value goods exports from Taiwan to mainland China, okay? And this has been about, you know, just under $1 trillion, $1,000 billion, just under, in the past 10 years. And this is not the type of, we're talking about $1 trillion in one direction in 10 years. You're talking about $125 billion or $126 billion in 2021 alone. This is going up and up and up. Every year, there was a little hiccup around 2015, but the trend overall, and you can look at the Statista site and you can go back, maybe look at the 20-year run, and you'll see what's happening in reality. And this is what we talked about when kind of the China thing first came on the radar screen back in March, because people were like, oh, Russia's seizing these territories in Ukraine. Is China going to seize these parts in Taiwan? And, you know, at the time we say China does not need to. China's not creating a crisis. China's happy with the status quo. And that's why we always refer back to psychology of statesmen, how statesmen think. Generally speaking, once you assess that a leadership in a country is not a personality leadership, in other words, the proclivities and kind of neuroses and mental hiccups and things like this, paranoias or whatever of a leader are not determining policy in China. So we've determined that. That's you know, maybe you have like these little kind of tin pot dictatorships or Noriega or something, or you know what, even like a Cuba with Castro or something like this. His personality, you know, very much have a strong force over the direction of the island, you know, the policies and the narrative and kind of the, well, really kind of the cult of personality around himself too, right? So China doesn't have that. Then the other question you look at is in maybe game theory or decision-making models. And then what you arrive at is, okay, like China has sufficient structures in decision-making that avoid groupthink, Abilene paradox, or, you know, decision-making outcomes that are derived from ideology over, you know, practical reality, right? So there was a crisis in China before under Mao and the Cultural Revolution where the ideology was leading a lot of these things, which led to a lot of disaster. And so China had to kind of turn around and kind of reorient towards, no pun intended, to reorient around, to reorient. Anyway, you get the idea. So now look at the volume of U.S. imports from Taiwan over like a 35-year spread or something like this. And it's peanuts. I mean, you're getting maybe over the course of 35 years, you're getting maybe, you know, a fraction of that. You've got, 10 years ago, the high was $41 billion. Also, just to bear in mind, with all of that, the U.S. is running a trade deficit with Taiwan. So just understand the economics. The U.S. is running a trade deficit with Taiwan. China is running a trade surplus with Taiwan. Taiwan has sold, three times as much in dollars to China than it has to the U.S., and that three times over one-third the period of time. So it's not even apples to apples. It's much more than three times. It's some figure less than 10 times. That's the reality. So, as you know, trade and business kind of is the horse. And it's possible, just like with Ukraine, just like with Europe, okay, their actual trade with Russia in 2014, just off the top of my head, you had bilateral, the total volume of trade between Russia and the EU in 2014 was, I think, just under $500 billion. And I don't know on which side is the... Well, no, we do know. It would be the trade deficit would be on the European side. We know that because we know that Russia doesn't run these deficits as a policy. They don't go into the deals that run deficits. Maybe with a microstate and they have a subsidy and they're buying something else at the market price or whatever. But that's how we can... Yeah, that's how we can sort that one. Most assuredly, Europe has the trade deficit on that point, but then that allows them, to, with that energy at that price, to produce things which, in theory, could make money if the EU wasn't organized as disastrously as it is. But in understanding what has happened with China, again, there's no need for China to move on Taiwan. The status quo has been acceptable, but there's some gray area here, and maybe that status quo isn't acceptable anymore if the Taiwanese government is going to do something very strange. Very strange. And the best way to understand this is a dance, okay? There's a dance between mainland China and Taiwan. And the dance, and it's a game, because both consider themselves to be the de jure government of China, only mainland China's government, when you think about China, only that China is the de facto. So finally, the UN, I think Albania or somebody made the motion or something like that, and then there was a General Assembly, and okay. What happened is Taiwan, known as the Republic of China, lost its status as the UN representative of China. And that makes perfect sense because you had an actual Chinese government representing over a billion or 900 million people at the time, whatever it was. And there wasn't a way to deal with them at the level of the UN because we had this policy in the West of recognizing Taiwan as China. This is not the minor stuff, by the way. This is super important. Okay. Now, up until the 90s, okay, there was one political party in Taiwan, the Kuomintang, right? And with mainland China, actually, the Kuomintang and the Chinese Communists agreed on quite many a few things, and also they share a reverence to with Sun Yat-sen. But the Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang were not really at odds with the Chinese Communists. In fact, they were most of the time an alliance. And also, the Chinese Communists built their organization out of an entryism program in the Chinese nationalists. So the Chinese Communists were in the nationalist resistance against the Chinese occupation. And so you had we're not trying to give the whole history of China, but just to understand, people know that there was like a warlord period and you had a fractured China. You have a lot of weakness for hundreds of years under the Manchurian dynasty. And then the English are able to come in, and do the opium stuff and kind of weaken China. So then China, although it had been a major player through the, 1600s in the world, they had their significance, sort of like weak Germany in at different times in history. There was a weak China, and it was divided. So all of this kind of introduction of talking about Western European ideologies is just part of this process of how China is dealing with really the consequences of colonialism. Because you had, leadership in these movements coming out of Hawaii, the Chinese diaspora. This is going back to to the 19th century even. And a lot of these intellectuals, talking about Sun Yat-sen and later Chiang Kai-shek, people had understood, and even though there had been a Russian Revolution, okay, and Chinese communists were inspired by that, among the Chinese, you have to understand that the Kuomintang's beliefs of nationalism and socialism, the people that would go on to found the government of Taiwan today, right, were socialists and nationalists. And they were organized very much, they had been influenced by the communists, of course. I mean, the communists inside, there had been a disaster once, I think in 1927, if history serves correct, where the communists did a public display of their force inside the Kuomintang, and they all decided to mobilize, and then they were killed. That was, I think, 1927 or 26. That was a very stupid move. And it showed that, like, the communists emerging from within the Kuomintang, out of the Kuomintang, was premature, right? But the Kuomintang adapted from the communists many of the things that they were importing, like the Leninist conception of a vanguard party. Anyone who wants to get things done, probably politically at some point, needs to adopt some of those methods. Even, Bannon has called himself a Leninist. And he means that he's a Leninist in the same way as the Kuomintang, and in the same way of the organizing principles of Chiang Kai-shek, who, while not a communist like Lenin, and while the communists of China also supported these ideas of Lenin and forming like a vanguard party, you have to understand that when you're talking about China, you're not talking about this inherently pro-Western, you know, freedom-loving, whatever kind of I support the latest thing type of Sorosian stuff. This is actually, they're not the communists, but there's something else very serious too, you see. And looking back, I mean, and I don't play counterfactual history, but had the Kuomintang come to power instead of the communist in China, and had the Kuomintang develop similar leadership based on similar structures. So we talk about the, you know, Leninist party structure, and then evolving past some of those blind spots that you can encounter, like from that, such as Abilene paradox, groupthink, and whatnot. And to move, and to also not fall into, let's say, groupthink or personality leadership. We're talking about kind of how in the field of IR and decision making processes, and, you know, we talk about this. China would look almost the same. And as a geopolitical reality, and however other, you know, powers in the world perceive China, you know, it would still be the China question. So this has nothing to do with communism, by the way. Only in the historic sense, in terms of looking at what were the balance of powers and the ideologies du jour, you know, on the taking, on the offering, 100 years ago. But that's like the filler. That's just like, it's not even a plot device. It's tertiary to the outcomes of China, the ideology involved, whether it's Marxism-Leninism or national socialism conservatism like the Kuomintang. Potato-potato in many senses. As long as you had a government oriented towards sovereignty, industrial development, and export model of finished goods, not raw materials, but finished goods. That's a critical aspect of development. So with that out of the way, and now you know you're hearing from somebody who doesn't give a fuck about whether these people, we have to stop this or this. No, we're not talking, this is not a domino theory, and we're not dealing with this stuff. We're just talking about a civilization called China, right? And so what has effectively happened is that the Kuomintang government of Taiwan, calling itself the Republic of China, agrees with the Chinese communists on certain things. For example, one China. In other words, the Kuomintang, they never considered Taiwan to be a country, and they don't consider Taiwanese to be an ethnicity. You know, I suppose that during the time of the Dutch and Spanish on Taiwan, you've got different people from like the, you know, Guangdong province and others that migrated in greater numbers to Taiwan. You know, but there, like we said, there actually had been a Chinese government in exile some time ago. And sorry, hello? Okay, sorry. I crashed. There had been this, and we talked about the Ming-Qing transition, or the Manchurian, so-called Manchurian invasion. And so this led, kind of similar, we're trying to find like echoes and mirrors in the past, okay? So this ended the Ming dynasty and began the Qing dynasty of Manchurian rule, okay? Some of these areas are actually part of Russia today, where some of these Manchurians came from, and they had been like part of this going back in Chinese history for a while. This is not like a totally alien people, but, you know, there's different... China's a civilization, not a single ethnicity, just to understand. It's a region of the world that happens to also be a single nation state. But don't think of it as like the Chinese ethnicity. I mean, people talk about the Han ethnicity as being like a plurality or a kind of theme, but there are limitations there as well. But it had happened to be that the government, the Chinese government, fled to Taiwan before, or you know, the Ming, a leadership or a prince of the Ming dynasty, established a government in exile out of Taiwan, is what happened. That was, I don't know, like around 1630, so quite a long time ago, 1650, I don't remember when, but it was around 1650, let's say. So there is a precedent for, you know, like, because Taiwan is militarily defendable, like land invasions, you need a very high ratio of attackers. You need a very big number of attackers to defenders to land success. Think about Normandy or, you know, the Omaha Beach or something like that, right? And, but this is not what's, you know, been preventing China from invading Taiwan. It's the reality is that Taiwan has been progressing under Kuomintang leadership through a dictatorship from, you know, 1949, 1950. They had an emergency dictatorship that suspended all of these things about democracy and freedom. They instantaneously suspended them. All the things that they might have gained traction in foreign audiences critiquing the communists for. In fact, as a nationalist, corporatist regime in Taiwan, they did the same, maybe even worse. And they didn't really experience liberalization, just like with a lot of places, whether they were like right-wing dictatorships or these kind of communist bloc countries. They didn't liberalize in the sense that we would talk about, you know, freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, competing political parties, things like this, until the 90s. So just keep this in mind, what's going on with Taiwan. And so up until this period, actually up until recently, maybe just in the last decade, you had a Kuomintang rule unstopped on Taiwan, claiming itself as the Republic of China, okay? The most important thing for China about this Kuomintang idea is the Kuomintang government in Taiwan agrees with the One China policy. They actually met more recently about where does mainland China and Taiwan China, where do they sit in relation to each other on coming together? And plus side is they agree on One China. Okay, they disagree on who that government ought to be. So we're actually back to our original problem. They also oppose any peaceful integration. The Kuomintang opposes any peaceful integration of, to make this One China policy a reality. So that's kind of weird, right? Now, despite all that, okay, you can look at the traffic on the trade, okay? In reality, whatever's going on in government of Taiwan, business, Taiwanese business, is naturally gravitating towards mainland China business. Okay, that's the tail of the dollars that you look, that's the tail of the tape. That's what you're looking at here, okay, in figure one. And that's a very happy status quo for Taiwan and for China, right? What happened is that there was a movement in the Kuomintang in the 70s and 80s for reforms and liberalization against the dictatorship. And this is a very important change, not just because of it introduced multi-party elections to Taiwan, but this group that emerged out of the Kuomintang, actually outside of the Kuomintang, and then inserted into the Kuomintang, and then broke off from the Kuomintang and made the modern, whatever, Democratic Party, the Democratic Party of Taiwan today, the Democratic Progressive Party. And the DPP now, this is the problem, the DPP has actually replaced the Kuomintang and controls the executive assembly, like yuan and the parliamentary yuan, like the parliamentary assembly, like the kind of several branches of government, effectively, just to understand this. Leaving just courts. And of course, you know how courts work and judges and stuff. They tend to just go with the powers of the other branches over time. That's the reality. So that's what actually happened. And you can actually see that this party came out on a Sorosian agenda, intersectionality, LGBTQ, a lot of things that don't really pertain to like that many people in Taiwan. It's really, you can see this international posturing and this kind of trying to present Taiwan not as a social nationalist dictatorship that could have been a Chinese government, except for the communists being the Chinese government. The Democratic Progressive Party rejects the One China policy. And of course, they reject the One China policy from the perspective of China, of mainland China controlling Taiwan. But they also reject the KMT concept that the government in Taiwan is some, you know, like fetus or something, or prototype of what's going to become a Chinese mainland government from this political party, you know, from this Kuomintang political party based in Taiwan. The Democratic Progressive Party has let go of that illusion that Taiwan is going to be considered the Republic of China, and that it's going to regain its seat on the UN, and that it's going to be handed the keys to Beijing. Like, that's just crazy. Like, how is that going to happen, right? That's not reality. So there's a realism in the Democratic Progressive Party that also opens some interesting doors. So there's a China, there's a colonial angle from the West on China, which manipulated KMT politics and then manipulates and kind of creates a Democratic Progressive Party politics. But China is also in, you know, seeing where it fits in with both, okay? Because with the Democratic Progressive Party, very interestingly, while they appear to take a firmer line on certain things with China than the Kuomintang, they also promote greater economic integration. They also don't consider themselves Chinese. They've been promoting something called Taiwanese nationalism. This idea that they're no longer claiming to be China. They're no longer claiming, of course, to be Chinese. They're no longer claiming to be the government of China. So in terms of the war of position, that's all plus for China. In other words, the government in China today doesn't have to deal with a Taiwanese government that calls itself China. That's a plus. The flip side is they've become kind of at odds with the status quo, and they've become kind of at odds, this Taiwanese government has become at odds with the status quo. It's become at odds with, they're reaching a breaking point in a bipolar policy of taking this kind of engineered for Western consumption only, by the way, hard stance against mainland China, and a lot of focus on weapon systems and who's going to defend us. This is all the political chattering class of this dangerous Democratic Progressive Party of Taiwan. This intersectional, I support the latest thing, LGBTQ plus P, whatever thing. Now, do they really believe it? Probably not. Again, everything for Western consumption. Bannon's never going to tell you the truth about Taiwan. Bannon hates Chinese people, by the way. He pretends to love Chinese people. He loves Chinese people to be weak. He loves the Chinese people of a tiny island of Taiwan. He doesn't love when China can be a geopolitical threat to his children's future going to Annapolis and West Point. Catch my drift? So, he's a careerist. And, you know, he's drifting his children into the military, etc. But That has been very disastrous. These stupid things that the Democratic Progressive Party in Taiwan says, and it's very different from the more responsible, despite, you know, at times maybe even seem hardline on certain things, kind of actually of the Kuomintang. But it's very different. So it's, you see that there's these kind of funny little dance going on because you have these different positions on the relationship with China, and you can see the Western angle of how to manipulate that outcome, and you can see the Chinese mainland angle of how that works. Like, if Taiwan no longer claims that they're the Republic of China, and they're just, now they're claiming that Taiwan is like a people in the sense of, you know, what we would talk about, the self-determination of people. That's ridiculous, because we just disclosed the genesis of where these, you know, inhabitants of the island of what the Portuguese called Formosa are coming from. And yes, there was some indigenous people at some point, you know, in time, but you have this 500 or plus, you know, long history of mainland China seeing and treating Taiwan as another province of China. You just get there by a little boat trip, not a big one. Does that make sense? So now that's how we can grasp these things. See, it's not as black and white as it looks. And China never had an orientation towards a military capture of Taiwan, because they already have a model in Hong Kong about how to manage multiple systems or in one country, right? And Hong Kong is not independent. It is a part of China. They have local elections and they have different laws. The big kind of brouhaha that was kind of the thing recently with that was whether, in other words, they're so independent. The question was whether, you know, mainland China, to what right could they extradite or, you know, charge white collar criminals engaged in fraud, extortion, etc., laundering in Hong Kong? To what extent could they, you know, try them or, you know, use the mainland Chinese justice system? So you can see that couldn't be a conflict if China did not actually make good on and respect its own policies of different systems in one state, talking about Hong Kong, okay? And China shows Taiwan, look at Hong Kong, and says, look, this is, look at what happened after 1997, when the 100-year-long British lease ended, and mainland China reassumes complete sovereignty over Hong Kong. They didn't turn it into a communist province or anything like that. They didn't try to do a cultural revolution there. You didn't have students marching around 1968 in fucking light blue uniforms waving a red book around. You actually have, you know, Italian suits, German cars. You have a corporatist market system in Hong Kong still today. Okay, so think about power in your mind, and think about control, and think about the maps that the world looks at. But think about, if you were to build like a little empire, let's say you're gonna have Chinese takeout food empire. You're gonna create your own maps of your, you know, your in the world of all of your franchises and stuff, and that's your little empire. And likewise, just because you have like maps that are produced on this Westphalian concept of nation states and that the UN uses, and you have like this map, right, of the world that has all the countries on it, there are other maps that we don't see. There are other maps of corporate power, maps of corporate empires and things like this, okay? And or of the real existing political relationships, so political empires and things like this. And in reality, as part of a network and node model, from a bird's eye view looking at China-Taiwan relations, it operates as a single thing already. It's one China policy is in effect today in Taiwan. We just explained, and we showed on the economic front, okay, nearly $1 trillion, one side of Taiwan bought by China from Taiwan in 10 years, almost $1 trillion. That's one direction. Do you know that Taiwan does not have sanctions on China? We talk about, oh, they're going to have a conflict. Oh, this must be like this Iron Curtain, and it's like North and South Korea. No, fucker. No. It's like a free trade zone. People who are the children in Taiwan of the Kuomintang government have gone to school in mainland China, have joined the Communist Party and become, you know, elites in mainland China, and vice versa. We're not talking about two people, we're not talking about any of these things. You're just talking about basically like a, if Montenegro is kind of really part of Serbia, right? You can't say that Taiwan is not part of China. It's been part of China for nearly 1,000 years or something like this. It's been a huge step in a crazy direction for the Democratic Progressive Party to take up the mantle of Taiwanese nationalism because it's fake. Remember Shlomo Sand talked about the fiction of the Israeli people, and then he pointed out about social construction of the Bulgarian people in the 19th century, and then people got offended because people don't want 19th century romanticism about national formation to be challenged, even though that's like kind of the foundation of a lot of the petty Central European rivalries to this day, and in the Balkans. And we shouldn't really view Taiwan all that differently. Now, business elites in Taiwan are so, just look at that relationship. Do you think that $1 trillion in 10 years of, you know, in one way, I don't know what the total balance has got to be, greater than $1 trillion, maybe $1.5 trillion, you know, somewhere probably less than $2 trillion. I don't know. We could actually look, someone can pull it up on Statista. That would be the value of good exports from China, from mainland China to Taiwan between the same 10 years. And whatever that number is, those deals don't happen by email. Okay. These deals are not new, and they didn't happen by email. People get on planes and trains and in automobiles, and they meet. And Chinese and Taiwanese government and business leaders have been colluding and doing business the way business is done in a very serious way since the 1980s. Meditate on that for a minute. This is not North versus South Korea. This is not Serbs versus Croats. This is not Salvadorans against Mexicans. This is not even Ukrainians against Russians. This is a government in exile that most of the outcome of that exile has been reintegrated already into Chinese, you know, whether it's political or economic. And it's been this cabal, State Department, Sorosian push to replace the Kuomintang, the Chinese Kuomintang, from power in Taiwan to build a new type of progressive social corporate, you know, we talk about cultural corporatism. The new cultural corporatism. So not the old Kuomintang national socialist corporatist model, but a new I'd like to teach the world to sing and come put your wiener in my butt type of corporatism. Pinkwash imperialism, right? So gender fluidity as the ideological fucking state apparatus. That is just a shift in Taiwan, and that's kind of also irrelevant. That's, again, to signal to global Democrat type, you know, corporate fake left audiences who are going to buy into this pinkwashing of the Taiwanese political elite, so that you think things that just aren't true. That so that you think that there's something called the Taiwanese people and that they're the gays and the oppressed and the trans fluid. And then you have the Chinese communists who are far right wing, ultra conservative nationalists or something. Does that make sense? It should not make sense in terms of like what you think, but do you understand that that's the narrative coming out of the cabal? At the same time, with all of this stuff, they are all tied into the worst. This Western cabal, despite all these games that they're playing with Taiwan, this is just leverage and posturing and games. They are tied in with the more corrupt elements of the Chinese bureaucracy. And China doesn't just have a one China policy, okay? It has a show no fucking weakness policy. And so China has been undergoing all kinds of changes, right? Because when you build up a certain vector in your economy that's oriented very specifically a certain way, then those are the networks and relationships that grow, and they kind of grow their own roots, and they kind of create their own perpetuating momentum, and they kind of start to shape, kind of take on almost like a consciousness of their own and begin to shape policy. And what happened is, that's what happened with China's export economy. Because when you're tied to exports as a model, and then you're talking about the political economy and low wages and things that support that export model, right? You're sacrificing the growth of a middle class for the economic development and creating the, you know, relationships of dependence and so forth, right? That might position you well later on. But in order to make the best out of that, you actually want to disengage from global markets and then invest that and transform your export model into realizing that you have a growing middle class. You have, you know, another 600 million people moving from into the middle class, where they're going to want to have, you know, a 2,000 square foot house, you know, three bedrooms, two car garage. Like, these kind of 1950s things are growing very much in China right now. And so, you know, XJP, one of the main things that this government in China has had to do is drain the swamp, deal with the cabal, deal with the all of these from the prior Chinese administrations that had gotten in with the Clintons. They were in the World Trade Organization with the Soros stuff, a lot of stuff that they played games with. I mean, yeah, you had the situation, of course, at Tiananmen Square, okay. But after that, I mean, that represented a real attempt by external factions like Soros and others to do something in China and manipulate, actually, and change course. Like, a lot of these students that were protesting, by the way, at Tiananmen Square, were attacking the Chinese leadership as being revisionists from communism. They weren't, like, saying we want to have McDonald's or something. They were actually kind of inspired, they saw themselves as kind of like a new wave of even like cultural revolutionaries, most of them. But then you have different kind of student groups and different kind of outlayers and stuff, and some who believe all kinds of fucking things, and those are the ones that CNN and the New York Times and Soros affiliated outfits focused on in the interview, and how they characterize the leadership. That's how they did the same thing in Tahrir Square. That's how they did it with the Egyptian Arab Spring, okay? You had actual protesters were Salafi, were actually Muslim Brotherhood, okay? You have in the whole fucking country 25 Trotskyites or something like that, that maybe went to university in London and then moved back, and they got involved with the fucking ISO, and then they moved back to Egypt, right? And they have a Sorosian little front and some socialist stuff, and the Soros people convinced Westerners that the uprising, that the Muslim Brotherhood uprising in Egypt was actually a intersectional Trotskyite left, ultra left inclusive transhumanist teach the world to sing, you know, I support the latest thing revolution. And it wasn't, it was a fundamentalist Islamic revolution to start bringing in heavier elements of Sharia law and to commit Egypt to a fucking war in Syria. So, you know, think about Taiwan through that lens as well. And that's also kind of what was happening with Tiananmen Square, you know, number of decades ago, 30 years ago. So when we look at all of those things, okay, and you look at China, you have, it's so hard to untangle, because you have China shills that just love every fart that China makes, and then you have, you know, people that are terrified of China, and you're not quite sure if the problem is communism, if it's a big Chinese power. I don't know how people imagine things. Like, do they imagine that if China had been run by the Kuomintang, by the people, by the original government of Taiwan, I mean, if that hadn't happened, if the Kuomintang hadn't lost, if they had won power, do you really think, and if China continued to succeed and existed today, do you think that there would have been that much different? No. No. Kuomintang already exhibited a high amount of practical realism, pragmatism, and syncretism, integrating liberal ideas originally, then adapting to progressive and socialist ideas, nationalist ideas, of course, part of national liberation discourse. There was a time when the Germans and the Nazis had some interest in them, but they also had interest from the Soviets, and then you built the, really the Communist Party was kind of built, a lot of its membership out of the Kuomintang, even though there had been an independent group outside of the Kuomintang originally. The policy of entryism under the Third International, led by Zinoviev, authorized by Lenin, built up communist cells in the Kuomintang, who had strong influence on Kuomintang ideas. And also keep in mind that the Chinese communists intended for the Kuomintang to actually seize power and to establish a Kuomintang nationalist government, because what you have to remember about the communist theory at this time, from the Stalin period, was not this Trotskyite idea that you're going to replicate the Russian Revolution and have a Bolshevik party seize power and start building socialism anywhere in the world. No, they actually, despite being the product of a Bolshevik revolution, the international approach from the Third International under Zinoviev was fairly identical to pre-Bolshevik ideas about historical development. So you would need to go through the bourgeois democratic stage, the bourgeois democratic revolution. That's called the two-stage theory. So certainly it's clear that the from the perspective of ideology, that there was no intention by the Chinese communists to seize power that would have been in line with their two-stage theory. It wasn't until the course of until you got into World War II, and you have the partisan movement, you have the Soviets against the Nazis, and you have this establishing of communist governments, not the bourgeois democratic stage of development governments, but just go straight to socialism governments, right? So actually breaking with Marxist and even Leninist theory, I mean, you know, you would have to argue really what Lenin's April thesis was really about versus, you know, Trotsky's concept of permanent revolution. But you can see the resolution in Stalin's socialism in one country. And that was not considered to be, the socialism in one country model of Stalin was not considered to be a model for anyone else. That was actually a sui generis kind of outgrowth of very unique circumstances in Russia. Well, that was really the party view of the communists. It wouldn't be that crazy that Stalin would agree with the anti-Comintern leaders of the Axis powers on the, and with Western countries on They actually eliminated the international at this time, and they replaced it with the common form. So they replaced the common turn with the information network, not like a, you know, this is what the marching orders for communist parties in other countries are. You see, they kind of had to get away from that. So that hasn't been the case for a long time. For you McCarthyists out there. And what you have then is now China, they're completely showboating right now. And all of this is so fake. It's ridiculous, man. It's so fake. Just because Soros, you know that this is where Soros and Bannon work together. Okay, this is just the American Eagle attacking with the right wing and attacking with the left wing. It's the fake left and the fake right, but they just create this discursive narrative and it kind of confuses people about who's with who and everything like that. If you don't think that Republicans and stuff have been like the China party also, like you've been asleep. The games that they've been playing, obviously it can be confusing because you're not sure whether they're investing in China or trying to overthrow China or what, because it seems like they're supporting China when they invest in it. Yeah, they're trying to gain leverage. China has only allowed a certain amount, you know, of its assets to be traded internationally by these types of people, right, who play the game, who gamble. They're not in the position to allow their export economy and then the financial, the debt and finance aspect behind, right, their export economy. They need to keep the financial in line so that the so that you still have the loan, the volume of loans and the, you know, interest rate scheme in place. But that has to be reoriented. I think they have to maintain their investment into East Africa and will continue in also in the South Pacific and, of course, Indochina. But that's, in the scheme of things, a very different from being the primary, you know, let's say spare parts or export, you know, for certain Western economies. That's a big change that we will expect to see. And if you want to think in terms of fairness or something, or trade-offs, let's say, even though this is totally irrelevant to what some fly like myself on the chariot wheel of history, you know, yelling charge, right? It doesn't matter what I fucking think, but, you know, one might say, hey, China, you know, is going to have some symbolic assertion over Taiwan. And I say symbolic because it really kind of already has Taiwan where it wants Taiwan to be. It's better for Taiwan's problems to be Taiwan's fault anyway. And then all of the things that Taiwan produces with its, you know, know-how and its money and its labor, its capital, is like benefiting China today. So, God, this is so fake. If China were to like do something militarily in Taiwan, I think first you would see more like some assassinations and coup type stuff. Might not even pop up on our radar screen because it could be like murders and behind the scenes stuff. And I mean, you know, you wouldn't, if I were to say, oh, you know, Tsang Wen, the president of Taiwan, of the Republic of China, was assassinated, you would have to look up who Tsang Wen was. You see what I'm saying? So what happened in Taiwan, okay, is a realization by the Western powers that Taiwan's one-party nationalist social dictatorship was gravitating towards China through its tone, its language, but also in its business. And what has happened with the Democratic Progressive Party is they have not been able to, and we question if they wanted to, stop the growth of Taiwan-China integration, economic integration, but have changed the tone and have positioned things that cannot be considered an affront to Chinese sovereignty of the mainland, because they're claiming that Taiwan is a nation, that Taiwan is a country. It's not the unrecognized China. It's something else now called Taiwan. And that has been the biggest shift in Taiwanese thinking on the subject of one China. That has been the rise of this so-called baseless Taiwanese nationalism. All they are missing is Taiwan and a nation. And once you have Taiwan and a nation, you can talk about Taiwanese nationalism, but there are no Taiwanese people. There's no Taiwanese language. There's no Taiwanese history, which is not Chinese history, unless we're, you know, anthropologists of indigenous people that lived on the island, you know, tattoos and nose piercings and spears and stuff. Those are people. But the Chinese kind of been exterminating and integrating them for 500 years. I don't mean maliciously or, you know, whatever, genocidally, but just extermination is a tough word, but, you know, they've been erased, maybe through natural processes. People like in the Jungle Book, you have all these little Taiwanese, you know, Mowglis venturing into the Chinese port cities in Taiwan and becoming, you know, Chinified, I guess. They've become, you know, Sinification of Taiwan is a long process over the past 500 years. But nobody disputes that Taiwan is China, except for the government in Taiwan today. So they have not, by the way, done sanctions against China. All of this stuff about Spratly Islands and China's development of island building military bases in the South China Sea, that's real stuff. But it's also not stoppable. It's also not happening, you know, on the Canary Islands or in the Bahamas. So that's what we talk about in looking at revisiting the post-war international law and looking at attempts to build by the West to redefine things and call it a rules-based system. If they're going to open the door to revisiting international law, the reality, the gravity of the situation today does not lend itself towards a unipolar world power establishing on its own, or, you know, in concert with the so-called international community to establish a rules-based system. Rather, it's true that there's an impetus to revisit the post-World War II world order. That is true. But the sensible approach that is actually being taken, not in language, but by actions, by big powers in the developing world, right? It's in the actions that they're taking. And those actions cut against all the old narratives, all the old way of things. So this is how I think about it. This is, I think, a very good approach to use, and you're gonna take this stuff in and think about what I'm saying and, you know, apply and adapt the things that make sense to you, hopefully to your own thinking. That's why I'm here. And I hope that's why you're here. But there has not been a push for Taiwanese independence, realistically. This is just a dangerous puppet Soros-created government in Taiwan. And Taiwan has made itself be something of like an Amsterdam. If China is Europe, then Taiwan has made itself kind of like an Amsterdam or Portugal in terms of drugs, prostitution, human trafficking. We shared very reliable data from numerous sources some months ago. Taiwan is, you would think it would be like Thailand or something, right? Taiwan is like a regional leading hub in human smuggling. Child prostitution, white slavery, and human trafficking. These are things which, you know, the mainland government has been pushing against. So I don't want to be unfair to Taiwan because, you know, if they haven't mirrored China's enforcement, then just the natural flow would be for a lot of people to go to Taiwan and stuff. So unless Taiwan had actually increased its own enforcement, I'm not trying to blame Taiwan for being one of the human trafficking hubs, but the fact that Soros is there also, and that this is all kind of spiked at the same time, it's very hard, is what I'm saying, to ignore correlative data. Right, you have the Democratic Progressive Party in China. It's a Soros project that Steve Bannon loves. You have this Soros government in Taiwan, rather. Did I say China? I meant Taiwan. Republic of China, not the People's Republic of China. We'll just say Taiwan from now on. That's also when I say the Isle of Formosa, all the same thing. Republic of China, Taiwan, Isle of Formosa. And there hasn't been a crisis. And what you're seeing right now probably involves, for people like Pelosi, small games with microconductor, microchip stuff and stock market and her husband, pump and dump type stuff. Like her visit maybe might have pumped up some value in something. Yeah. And then she bought before the trip, her husband bought before the trip, they built up the value from her trip, something like this. And then all the repercussions and the outcome or the whatever China sanctions on Taiwan over that, maybe, you see, then it's going to be dump. It's going to dump, and then people left holding the bag, right, with worthless stock. And she's trying to, what you have to understand is these people are using, from their own narrow understanding of reality, but our understanding of their motives are even more narrow unless we're kind of more initiated into their way of being, right? But in their own limited way of understanding, you know, China is a very difficult nut to crack. And it's not as simple as the Chinese communists are the Chinese communists. You have to understand that there are secret societies going back in China for a very long time. And there's an awareness, of course, that like Marx was German and Lenin was Russian, and that these are kind of like not Chinese ideas per se. There's an underlying Confucianism in the system, but there's also, you will find, what you'll find is that the differences, and that kind of how we started, the differences between the Chinese communists and the Kuomintang are really not that different. And even though in communist ideology, you have this working class dictatorship of the proletariat, what you actually find in modern China is that the families, there was a warlord period, a civil war, the Chinese occupation, right? Talking about the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the teens, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, right? This whole long crisis period in China, really going back to the 19th century. And in this whole long crisis, right, you get the stuff come out of it, okay? And among the things that come out of this, is that we think that a communist takeover has happened in China, when really what you had among many other aspects, but just talking about within the elites and the ruling and the wealthy, like the millionaire families of China, and there was many of them, you know, because these different warlords and stuff had sponsors, or they were from these families and stuff. And we've talked about failed states, and we've talked about the process of building, and we've talked about before, just in talk about, you know, counterinsurgency and failed states and warring states. When you talk about the degradation of force potential, degradation of institutions of power, warlordism is the very base unit where you have the warlord cult of personality. Maybe he has a title. Maybe he is a pretender to a throne of something or whatever, or an ex-commander or whatever, right? Or a religious leader, or just has a reputation for things on the battlefield, okay? That's warlord. Now, beyond the cult of personality, the warlord system, for two warlords to join forces on a permanent basis, now you need to have an idea. Is it a national idea? Is it a social idea? Is it a religious idea? Is it, you know, obviously there's a practical aim, which is to unify the force. Now you're moving in the direction of building perhaps an ideology which could then serve the foundation for a legal system and a method of regulating and moving away from the personality leaders and into, this is a system where multiple elites don't have to be each a warlord, but we can all come together. And what's the ideology? Is it liberalism? Is it nationalism? Is it socialism, communism, fascism? What is it going to be? Monarchism? What, right? But it's got to be something new, maybe, or which always is just a syncretism of the actual existing parts out there that you can, you know, build from. A little from this, a little from that. And that's what the Kuomintang did. Okay, they took a little from this and a little from that. But none of this along the way was thinking that Taiwan, that there's some Taiwanese people that have been suffering under Chinese oppression. Like, the Taiwan government are Chinese. The sad and, you know, regrettable story of the indigenous people of Taiwan is a story that's been over for 400 years. So this is not about a big country picking on a little country. This is about a contest over what was the original seat of government for China, or what is the, not original, but rather the legitimate seat of power for China. And then, as a consequence of a one China policy actually in effect, despite whatever words come out of the mouths of Taiwanese government under the Kuomintang, it's moving in the direction of China. The attempt to build the Democratic Progressive Party, this Sorosian front in Taiwan, okay, has been a failure. In terms of, it did not stop or put the brakes on economic integration with mainland. And all it really did, because there's still a lot of KMT voters, right? The blue coalition. So talking about the green, and you have the blues and the greens, the blue, basically two main factions fighting for power in Taiwan is, I think, the blue Kuomintang Alliance and the green, which is the Democratic Progressive Party and other center left, I support the latest thing parties backed by Soros. And they just completely misrepresent the shape of things to the outside world versus what's really going on in Taiwan. The reality is that the Kuomintang governments, in reality, and as you see from business interests as well, the real aim is to negotiate what a Hong Kongification of Taiwan looks like. And it's not been something you have to sit at the table to negotiate. You can see it unfolding in real time. Every time the ink dries on a deal, on a business deal between Taiwan and China, which, as we said, has been, you know, over $100 billion a year. And on average, about 90, maybe billion dollars a year for the past decade. That's just under $1 trillion. Pretty remarkable. Tells a totally different story than Taiwan versus China. There really isn't a Taiwan versus China. There's a Soros. There's a mental illness, a global mental illness among satanic elites in the West that are hyperventilating kind of a decided and old issue. They're hyperventilating, they're resuscitating that through hyperventilation. Okay? It's a dead issue. And no one in Taiwan thinks otherwise. And no one in the Taiwanese military thinks that they're anything more than a police force. And there's no one, there's no Taiwanese general that thinks they're going to defeat the PLA. And there's no Taiwanese business owner, whether it's a Fortune 500, Forbes, or smaller, that thinks that China is bad, that they want to stop selling to China, that they want to stop buying from China. In fact, there's really no one in Taiwan who wants what the government in Taiwan wants, except for some bizarre whatever demographic, electronic voting, and a huge multi-billion dollar marketing campaign from Western philanthropy in Taiwan. They're trying to confuse the issue, maybe erase the history, or introduce a lot of things that would be alien to us. Like we think in terms of how we think of it. They have conspirology there. They have like Chinese conspiracy theories. You know, you see what I'm saying? They have like their own myths and stuff, and they have, you know, whatever. So we're totally outside of that bubble. And part of that is why China is such a difficult nut to crack for the West. And that's been part of a big aspect of Chinese sovereignty. You know, it was very hard for the British to try to manage and control China, even using like heroin, opium or poppy, whatever. Very hard. And the Chinese, there's not a single Chinese mentality, and you have all of these different regions, and you can't identify always, if you're an outsider, where people are from. I mean, imagine having to speak all the dialects, knowing all the accents, being basically, to be a China expert, right, you'd have to be Chinese and work for the State Department. But just because you knew those things doesn't mean that you understand whatever the Chinese equivalents to, you know, secret societies, like their version. I mean, because you have to understand, and I know this is difficult, but the Jesuits got very active in China, you know, 400 years ago, and it's been kind of a mess. Chinese history is kind of a mess. China's in a whole process of reassembling their history. Still, they're trying to get it where they want it to be. Too much interference from Smithsonian Institute, all of the theft, all of these digs. The British basically looted China, all of these historical sites. Anything Chinese that's in a museum in England should be repatriated to China. See, these are the problems that are kind of going on. And that's symbolic. That's just superficial. That's symbolic for, if you actually look at how Chinese history has been rewritten and stuff like that, and it's being rewritten today. There are people out there today who don't know even these very basic things about Taiwan that we talked about. So that's how I view the Taiwan issue. I had the opportunity being from Los Angeles. We have a giant Chinese population, by the way, like in fucking near Montebello and Alhambra and what is it? Like areas near, where is it? Like, yeah, I said Alhambra, near Pasadena, maybe like the south and east of where Pasadena is. And lots of Chinese everywhere. And a lot of them, and the thing is people come from all over. And some people are from Taiwan, and that used to be the case before, and more people from China. And guess what? They mix. They're all the same. They're not, like, there's not these things, and they do the same deal, you know, on the spot. I've met a lot of, I used to go to a bar. I know these are like, this is anecdotal, right? I went to a bar a lot, you know, in my early 20s called the Good Luck Bar off of the, you know, where Sunset and Hollywood intersect, actually, like that weird where they do the do-si-do kind of past like Western. And so I'm not sure if it was in Hollywood or Sunset, but it was this Chinese bar called the Good Luck Bar. And the owner was this old Chinese guy. And he was very Taiwanese, you know, always like, where are you from? Taiwan, you know? And I was, it was kind of a slow night. I was having a beer or something like that. And I was talking to him. I said, what do you think about China? He's like, I'm so proud to be Chinese. I love what China's doing. And I was very surprised because he's very, you know, if you ask him where he's from, he says Taiwan. He doesn't say China. But asking about China, he was very proud of being Chinese, very proud of China's accomplishments in the past 50 years, for better or worse, whatever you think of them aside, just talking about my conversations with people. And, you know, you can see that. And if you understand the Chinese diaspora, there's not, you know, maybe 50 years ago, okay, but there's not this hatred for mainland China today that you find. In the Chinese diaspora, yeah, there are groups that are very organized around a very interesting organization called the Falun Gong. It's like a cult. And on the face of it, like just for Western, maybe in San Francisco and places, New York, they lead like Tai Chi in the park. All fine and good. Very many interesting ideas in the Falun Gong cult. The mystic who leads it or who did before has many interesting ideas about how the spiritual realm works, which probably are true, in my opinion. They are suppressed by the Chinese government because the Chinese government is scientistic. It's anti-mystical. It's materialist. Comes out of that Marxist tradition of hyper-scientism or hyper-materialism. Not as in consumerism, although it's become that. I guess one leads to the other. Hello, Soviet Union, cocaine disco. So you have these issues with Taiwan that are being manufactured. And just knowing the real story, it helps to let go of a lot of the BS around it. Because there's not really a Taiwan issue, except for the ones that we collectively, the West, decide to make. So, you know, China doesn't have a population problem. The economy is very strong. But people are becoming, you know, more bold, and they're protesting about issues relating to, well, as the outcome of China's preference to an export economy, which means that they have suppressed their currency. So relative to the dollar, so probably is accurate, but everyone manipulates currency, but they've all obviously have enjoyed an export model. So they wanted to have a weaker, you know, export currency. They actually have two currencies that they use, renminbi and the yuan. So these words sometimes are wrongly used interchangeably, but it's actually two sets of books. They kind of basically have like an industrial GDP money that people use, and they have kind of like a finance-based international currency. Very interesting. And then, you know, but China, even though they don't have an economic problem in terms of the fundamentals of the economy, and even though it's nowhere near collapsing, unlike maybe misinformed people might think if they pay attention to a lot of liberal and conservative Western media, the key underlying shared problem there being Western media and the defective ability to understand world events. So the problems that China faces are its growing middle class. I mean, there's solutions in there too. They're not hard problems. It just means it's also good for America. So what's good for Chinese people is good for American people, because Americans aren't doing well from, at this point in time, right, Chinese imports. The entire outsourcing labor and globalized production scheme has greater costs than long-term or even short-term benefits even at this time and foreseeably. I mean, we're moving in a direction kind of irreconvertibly that is less and less payoff on globalized trade. And an XJP did not disagree with Trump on many things, despite how the media has to portray things, even Chinese media, of course, and global media. XJP is primarily there to save and reorient China. There's a lot of tasks. The issue of Spratly Islands and Taiwan and the South China Sea and kind of all this stuff relating to its sovereignty over its trade lanes and its, you know, what it considers its ocean, its body of water. It's asserting this body of water beyond the, you know, whatever 200 nautical perimeter, you know, kilometers or miles that countries claim, by establishing, by kind of creating landfill islands and then calling that land and then putting base there and then kind of claiming that the 200 whatever mile, whatever the fucking case may be, excuse my idiocy on that fact, but you get there's some ocean territory that every country has, and they're kind of pushing that envelope. They're pushing that physical boundary. And the Philippines isn't happy about it, but they can't do very much because they're also very integrated into China. So these are Asian issues. And given how many things that we need to clean up in our own backyard and to make to make our country worth living in, just does not involve a confrontation with China. And it doesn't involve supporting Hong Kong or Taiwan. This is like a waste of time, money, shit you don't fucking understand to create conflicts you're not prepared to deal with. But what you are prepared to deal with is a closure of the supply lines and the trade. And that's why we talk about other things we talk about. It's not bad for China to be doing this, what they're doing. Consolidating, it's not good or bad. It simply is. It's just a thing that's happening. And it's going to lead towards, it's going to be part of a process that the present Chinese government gains in credibility from. And it's going to use that credibility to continue its position towards retrofitting its economy towards its growing middle class and not focusing on guaranteeing the never-ending growth, right, of its export economy. But there's many elites and oligarchs in China tied to the export economy. So you have an inter-elite conflict in China, which is potentially destabilizing. And that is the hypothetical, you know, linchpin that Western powers might try to push on. But for all these reasons we explain, that's not what it is. So so war is not inevitable. And, you know, China's elite have not planned for that in terms of their desired outcome, but everyone's made contingency plans. And so it's important to not be arrogant in understanding these outcomes or to characterize the whole position of a government based on a notion about what you think it's supposed to be trying to do. In other words, the Taiwan is not claiming that it's China, but it also can't claim that it's a nation in the sense of a people. So that's kind of a weird, now weird position they're in. It's actually a very bad position for their argument that has come together between this dance between the Kuomintang and the Democratic Progressive Party. China will win from that there. And it's what most Taiwanese people, to the extent, we're talking about this, the residents of Taiwan, okay, we're not talking about Taiwanese people, but the people who live on this place called Taiwan, they are already working in companies. Just think about employment. Like, you think that trade is just trade? Like, no, those are jobs. So everyone knows that relationship with China is good and important for their work and their life. you would have to have unjustified beliefs that are less rational than religious beliefs to think, because there's not justification, to think that Chinese elites are all part of a Jesuit or Vatican or Marxist or whatever conspiracy. That is just not how the world functions. And despite that, many conspiracies are true. But not knowing how power works, and by making yourself into a black-pilled propaganda agent of the establishment, because that's what they want you to think. They want you to think that there's a one world government and that everything is staged in this way so that you go around and mouth that bullshit off to people thinking that you're fucking smart, and just demobilizing and demotivating everybody you encounter with your bullshit. So whether you commit suicide, God bless, or, you know, whatever your issue is, you know, you are the tool of the elite. When you propose that they have global power over all things, that everything is part of a design, that, you know, I guess you gave them an IQ test and you believe them to be, you know, ultra geniuses, and that you worked with for them, so you know how they operate. I don't know what it is, why you have such confidence in their power, or why you believe in their, and why you worship their power so much. It's kind of bizarre to me. Why you would think that these Soros type people and stuff like are running the world. They are running the Western world to an extent, but even in the Western world, there's an inter-elite conflict. There's a resistance happening at all, you know, different levels. Let me look to see if there's like a specific question about that. I'm just looking at if we have any questions here. No, I don't see. Good. I mean, there was like some comments interesting I could have responded to, but nothing. People just want to know really like militarily, obviously, you know, come on. There's no contest there. It's not even like a Ukraine no contest. It's really like a Taiwan has a police force, you know? And then you have, like, the PLA. So, you know, the U.S. is never going to get behind Taiwan militarily with some view of victory. I don't even think they can get in militarily to back something before it happens. I just don't see it happening that way. There's just too much hegemony. China enjoys too much hegemony in the region. You couldn't even get, like, I don't even know physically what that looks like. Would you get American battle carriers and stuff? I mean, they're already kind of in the region, but would you have the aircraft? I mean, how would you do that and then not engage just to be there? Well, that bluff's going to get called. You're not going to engage U.S. Navy outside of Taiwan. Like, that's bizarre. U.S. is going to work through proxies, and its proxy there is Taiwan, and Taiwan doesn't want to do it. It's not even like they have like this Ukraine thing and they're building up like this army and stuff. It's not what's going on in Taiwan at all. So yeah, there's been like this recent stuff with the arms sales, and that's very annoying. And that's been the Democratic Progressive Party kind of going at odds with, you know, Taiwanese business, Taiwanese integration with China, like what most people work and deal with in their everyday life. Is going to deal with things like you go to Taiwan, you go to the store, you buy things, and things are made in China, things are made in Taiwan, it doesn't matter. This is all being created. This is all, like, you want to talk about what's manufactured is the discourse around it. That part is very controlled. But that's being controlled in response to things that aren't necessarily predicted. Sending Pelosi at that time is predictable. she has some personal interests. We talked about her likely whatever she's doing, whatever scam she's running, pump and dump, laundering, and why she went there. Okay. But come on. Does the Democratic Progressive Party really think that they're getting assurances from the Americans because Pelosi made a private trip? Meanwhile, you have the so-called Biden administration, the most pro-China government since Clinton. And they're saying, and you have Blinken saying, no, we don't really recognize Taiwan. We're not going to recognize Taiwanese independence. Well, that puts the interesting twist on things, right? Because we know that Soros and a lot of these same things operate very analogously. So it's very interesting to see how there's certain investments that are going to get pulled away, you know, like the Bidens and stuff. There's certain things they're going to get in trouble with. They already have. I mean, they were in bed with people in China that have been imprisoned and executed. That's the, you're talking about, we talk about the Bidens and the swamp people. Now, of course, real swamp, you get deeper. You're talking about dynastic banking families in the West. We know that. But we're talking about their henchmen and their minions and stuff, like elected officials and the Bidens and the people that are allowed to run around and collect, you know, 500 million or a billion here and there. This is not like the trillions and trillions of like the Rothschilds and, you know, these families like this. So we're obviously, we talk about these elites. It's a kind of a conflated word, but we're talking about this political class that uses and abuses the Senate in identical way to how it was used and abused in ancient Rome. You know, using your position in the Senate as part of a shakedown operation, money laundering, you know, or use diplomacy to threaten war and then receive bribes for peace and things like that. And everything in between. Like, those are very obvious ones, but just, you know, all kinds of games. And we talked about how you can manipulate stock. And you know how the congressmen have access to play games with stock manipulation. So insider trading information, everything like that. That is more probably relevant to Pelosi's trip. And then sparking all of these things now, you know, certainly think about how they're trying to shape up for November. And the thing is that a lot of Trump's base is correct on China trade issues with the U.S. at their fundamental urging, and what they want out of it is correct. But Taiwan doesn't, you know, creating the crisis in Taiwan can only serve a good pretext for for import substitution, industrialization inside the U.S., but that's going to be a weaker dollar too. So there's many things, and here's the thing. There are solutions and ways forward through all of this, and I understand that some of you hear what I'm saying and you're thinking, oh, that sounds just like what the elites are proposing and blah, blah, blah. And I say to you, no, they're losing control, and they propose things that are fucking inevitable, and they make it sound like they're the ones directing it, so it looks like the things that they want are coming into being, because that's like kind of one of the ways that you remain in power and hold credibility. Anyone who's probably worked on a governing board of a company or you know, board of directors, you deal with sociopaths, you know, people who like take credit for things. You know, like you work on a project at the board meeting, the other guy jumps up and then tells the boss, we've come up with this great new idea. That's how they're dealing with this collapse. Okay, they're not in the position to want to collapse things in the West. They've got you thinking that they want to do this. They're trying to figure out how to stay in power in the face of a collapse that's the result of their geopolitical failures to conquer China, Russia, and countries whose destinies are not controlled by Davos or the IMF. So that is our presentation on kind of some of the history and kind of what's going on with Taiwan, my take on things. If there were real issues of humanity and death and torture and pain and deprivation of life and liberty happening in Taiwan, you know, in reality, as a consequence of big bad China, like I would say something. I'm not Chinese. I don't have a fucking Chinese wife. You know, I'm not into, I don't do Kung Fu. You know what I'm saying? There's nothing about China that I'm all about. It's just another place with a fascinating history and many interesting potential futures. And I just have a lot of respect for that history. I have a lot of respect for Sun Yat-sen's work, for Chiang Kai-shek's work, the Kuomintang's work. I have a lot of respect. The communists' work, I have a lot of respect. What they've accomplished there, kicking out the Japanese, unifying the country, pulling 400-600 million people out of poverty. I suppose that in the time since the Chinese Revolution, 1949, until today, that hundreds of millions of people have died in China from old age, from incurable diseases, from diseases related to poverty and things like this. But keep in mind that with China, you have a country that has gone through three industrial revolutions in the span of 50 years. So if the first industrial revolution began in the West at the close of the 18th century, around 1770, 1780, China kind of got going with this process just all in the 20th century, really towards the middle of 20th century. You're going to crack a few eggs to make an omelet, and I'm sure they've cracked a few eggs in China to make that omelet. If you think about things from a military and survival perspective, what are the sacrifices necessary to make the final thing stronger in the end? What losses are acceptable, or what grinding through resources are acceptable towards better outcomes? Mao made disastrous decisions, ideologically driven decisions, almost, you know, almost Cambodian Khmer Rouge stupidity at the level of decisions that Mao made. Despite his genius as a military leader and in the Long March, as a statesman, catastrophic. And Chinese, there was actually a revolution in the revolution against these crazy Pol Pot type things that Mao was doing. And the Chinese communists have been cleaning that up, and cleaning it up since the 70s and the 80s in a very serious way. Then they kind of went too far in the other direction, where they were all everything just pursuit of the dollar and the export economy. And XJP has had to come in and now kind of middle things back towards using capitalist market mechanisms to build an autarkic middle national economy and growing a middle class, so that you have a consumer base based on, you know, income that can purchase the goods made, you know, in a growing economy, in a growing productive sphere in China. So that's going to be growing wealth. You're going to have the disinflationary outcome of new technologies and things like that. They're already prepared because they had a rotation of elites forced on them through a lot of crises in the 20th and 19th centuries. In the West, we haven't had a complete rotation of elites since around the time of the first industrial revolutions. And this has led to having an entrenched, you know, multi-generational ruling class that has kind of formed a breakaway culture and believes they can make a breakaway civilization. And there are parallel trends and possibilities for that kind of crisis to happen in China. And there are definitely Chinese oligarchical forces blind to maybe what's right, that are going in that direction. And so XJP has had a lot to do. He comes from the line of privileged families in China that either got behind overcoming the warlord period and got behind either or both, you know, Chiang Kai-shek and the communists, or first Chiang Kai-shek and then the communists. That was a very common practice too among Chinese families that saw that the warlord period and, you know, was bad, and obviously Japanese occupation bad, and were getting behind basically sovereigntist movements. And you had basically two choices, and they were actually working together and allied most of the time. So, so XJP actually comes out of a privileged Chinese family. And so he understands kind of like how the game works. He's not an outsider. He comes from the swamp. And he broke with the swamp. He turned against the swamp. He came out of the machine. He came out of the same machine that was built up around Jiang Zemin. So, of course, what do you expect, right? Anyway, I think that's a wrap for us today. You can look at, you know, people are going to, where we, I don't think I want to look that much moving forward at the military situation unless it gets very interesting. And I'm more looking at the internal stuff in Taiwan, like a coup or assassinations or things with the courts and things like this are going to be very important in Taiwan right now, because what you think of a military incursion of the Chinese military into Taiwan is like far beyond the top three or four methods for solving this crisis that are preferred by a mainland China. Does that make sense? The military option, it's in their mind, not requiring a military option for Taiwan was like a foregone conclusion, as much as 25 or 30 years ago. Does that make sense? So that's why I kind of like talk about the Chinese military in Taiwan today is very strange. Like you could see as a training drill or as a flex or as a posture or maybe, you know, building credibility, that those are all very real possibilities to see continued Chinese military activity around Taiwan, on Taiwan, landing an expeditionary force or something on Taiwan would be very, very weird, but could happen. It just seems that because you have what you, the problem of Taiwan right now with the Democratic Progressive Party and its magical capture of several branches of government all within a few years and backed by magical philanthropy from fucking Soros, that has probably thrown a wrench in things to an extent that the Chinese can see, but that doesn't change the fact of Taiwanese business. If you're going to have a corporatist conspiracy in Taiwan, if you're going to have a market capitalist conspiracy in Taiwan involving China, it's going to be against the Democrat Progressive Party and in favor of mainland China. That is the conceptual block that once you get your head around, then you see what's really going on in Taiwan. This has been Joaquin. This has been our show. I'll be back with you tomorrow. You know, try tuning in different times. I want to say same bat time, same bat channel, but that would be a lie. Peace. I'm out.